Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming to this hopefully final talk where I'm trying to summarize what we know about cuprate electronic structure at the atomic scale. So today I want to talk about the heart of darkness of that little field, which is the so-called pseudo-gap regime. And I want to talk about visualizing it directly at the atomic scale. See what does the n-body wave function look like when you get to this mysterious state. So this work is in collaboration with Uchida-sensei, Takaki-sensei, Onoguri-san, Kosaka-san, Dr. Esaki, and members of my group at Cornell. I need to remind you a little bit about what the pseudo-gap is in the cuprates. And I'm going to talk about different processes which can generate excitations across that electronic gap, both the superconducting gap and the pseudo-gap, when they can be distinguished from each other. And then how to image these excitations. That's the primary thing we actually do, is image the probability of generating an excitation. Now, in order to do that, I have to review two things I've commented on in the last few days, and I'll do that quickly. One is how to use quasiparticle interference to measure the momentum space energy gap structure, and the other one is the doping dependence of the excitation spectrum. And then I'm going to introduce several new results. One is by using a new technique of imaging tunneling asymmetry, which is the ratio of probability for injection divided by extraction at a given atom, we find that there is a very, very intriguing bond-centered ordered structure. It's not long-range order, so I call it modulations. Secondly, during this study, we discovered how to use the quasiparticle interference technique right down to the lowest doping, and that allows us to measure the structure of the superconducting energy gap in more detail than has ever been done before at low doping, and with more precision. And finally, I'm going to show you what does the pseudo-gap state looks like in terms of these new effects. Please stop me and ask questions. So let's take a simple-minded picture of the CuO2 plane today. Yesterday, I talked about all of the complex problems, but let's take a simple problem of a 2D plane, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper. Copper's in 3D9, oxygen's 2P6. That means there's one spin a half electron on each vertex of this square lattice. And the effective Hubbard energy is about 3 volts, so no double occupancy is allowed. So the simplest Hamiltonian would be a Hubbard Hamiltonian. There's a second order process of hopping, provided these spins are anti-aligned. Which produces an exchange energy, 4T squared over U. And that value of that number is 140 millivolts in the insulator. It's the highest, or among the highest, known in any solid state material. These materials are doped by removing a small number, let's say 1 in 10 of the electrons from this plane. And when we do so, we end up with this phase diagram. There's at low doping, you have the Mott insulator. As you increase the hole density, you get the D-wave superconductor. And over here, you have a metallic state. This shaded region here is where, when you come down in temperature, you make a transition into the so-called pseudo-gap regime. One reason why people don't call it the pseudo-gap phase is that no phase transition has ever been detected along this line. It's just some conversion from one arrangement of electronic from one form of, let's say, bulk susceptibility to another, from one heat capacity to another. But no clear signature of a phase transition and no long-range order has been detected. So in that regime, the uniform susceptibility is independent of temperature. Then when you cross this line, it begins to dive down very rapidly as if the spin degrees of freedom are frozen out. The heat capacity, the linear coefficient, has a metallic-like value until you cross this line, and then the heat capacity, the coefficient, dives down rapidly. And when you cross this line, you see the jump due to the D-wave superconductivity. and this is true everywhere in this part of the phase diagram. The separations of energies are very large here, from a few millivolts to hundreds of millivolts, and over here they come close together. In momentum space, this is a quarter of the first Brillouin zone, so this is the pi zero and pi pi point. In momentum space, there's a whole pocket, or what's reported to be a whole pocket. Certainly there is photo emission can be found on this line here. But in this part of the phase diagram, in the superconducting phase down here, there's a complete D wave gap. So this angle phi is the same as this angle phi. This is the gap magnitude measured in units of its maximum. And here's the D wave gap that you see in the superconductor. When you go up and you cross into this regime, part of this D wave gap disappears, leaving you with a metallic or ungapped angle. But then part of it is retained. A gap is still retained at some angles. Here it is. And if you go to a higher temperature, it is retained at a smaller number of angles, and so on until you cross this line. So this gap, this is a gap for generating excitations. It survives when you cross this line, but as you go up in doping, it gets narrower and narrower and narrower into this region near the zone phase. The states down here in the metallic region are coherent. They're well-defined momentum eigenstates. The states over here in this part of the phase diagram become, they lose their well-defined nature as momentum eigenstates rather quickly. The disappearance of this peak means that although there's a gap in the density of states over here, there isn't a coherent, well-defined momentum eigenstate. So what I've been trying to bring home to you is that we're facing this separation of scales. There are two extreme points of view about this separation of scales. One is that the separation occurs because of the structure of a correlated doped mod insulator theory, and I'll point out some models where that definitely does occur. And the other extreme is that this separation of energy occurs because there are two different states here. This is one state. You could think of it perhaps a charge density wave, something else. And this is another state, and they just have two different gaps and two different TCs. Now, we have known for 10 or 15 years at least that the magnitude of this scale, I'm going to call this linearly increasing energy gap maximum. I'll call that the pseudo gap for brevity. We've known the doping dependence of this slope from all kinds of different probes. And that has not allowed us to reach a consensus about an ability to distinguish between these two possibilities. So what we have been trying to do is not just to measure the gap, but to measure the whole details of the excitation spectrum and see if that gives us enough information to distinguish between these two possibilities. So again, as simplifying as much as I can, there are three classes of theories here. So one is strong correlations of the antiferromagnetically coupled spin a half electrons on the square lattice when it's doped with holes. And these ideas were first put forward by Anderson, and then there have been many very successful evolutions of this picture. This theory definitely, in all its different manifestations, does produce a gap which falls linearly with increasing doping, because the exchange energy J gets renormalized, it gets diluted by the number of holes in the crystal. This is widely accepted. So the existence of this line is completely consistent with this correlated doped mod insulator style theory. Other classes of theories are competing phases, several of which, the staggered flux phase and the d-density wave phase and the intra-unit cell orbital phases, also would have a large and possibly changing gap in the density of states. A different type of phase are these striped phases, where you order the spin and the charge in space. They can be viewed as a competing phase. So these are the two extremes, but as I mentioned, there is another class of theory which somehow bridges the difference here. Because there are models of electron or hole pairs crystallized in space. The existence of the electron pair, the dimer or the hole pair, is coming from the strong correlations of the doped mod insulator. It's coming from this side. But the crystallization is coming perhaps due to Coulomb interactions or interactions with the crystal, something unanticipated in these translationally invariant theories. The challenge for our little field has been to distinguish at some level between these three classes of ideas to explain this large unknown part of the phase diagram. Oh, that's a whole pear crystal from Sucheng Chang. Okay, so we use spectroscopic STM. We put our STM tip at each atom, measure the differential conductance as a function of tunnel current bias, and that gives us the density of states as a function of energy at that atom. Then we do that at every atom in the field of view, and we can then construct a map of the density of states as a function of energy and location. And that map has all kinds of interesting things in it: electron-phonon interactions, disorder in the superconducting energy gap, quasi-particle interference, all kinds of wonderful things. It has been a very productive new way of getting information from correlated electronic material. Okay, now, in the last year or two, we have discovered that the traditional point of view about tunneling spectroscopy does not survive the approach to the Mott insulator. There is a problem with using tunneling spectroscopy as you approach the insulator. And I'd like to explain it, if you don't mind. It's both interesting and important. Here's the tunnel current. It's got a matrix element term. It's got the WKB factor having to do with the distance of between the tip and the sample, and the square root of the product of the work functions, etc. This is the exponential diminution of the tunnel current as you pull the tip back. And then it's got the integrated density of states up to an energy controlled by the bias voltage. That's fine. Now, what about this variable here? This z here is where you put the tip. It's called a topograph, the elevation as a function of location. But how do we set it? Well, we keep the tunnel current constant at a fixed value, and we keep the bias voltage constant at a fixed value. And then we vary this number such that this equation is satisfied at every location. That's the definition of the topograph. It's the contour of constant tunneling current for a given voltage. Now, just humor me here. Let's look at this factor, which contains several unknowns: the unknown matrix element, the unknown work function variations, if they exist, plus this complex topograph. I could take this piece here, and so obviously it equals the current divided by the integrated density of states. Now let's go back to this equation. Originally I told you that DIDV, the differential conductance, is related to the density of electronic states. But in detail, DIDV, just take the derivative of this equation, DIDV is this number times charge times the density of states. And now let's substitute here from here. You see that DIDV is proportional to the density of states only if the integral over the density of states up to the setup voltage is homogeneous. If that integrated density of states is varying in space, then DIDV is no longer the density of states. Our observable gets mixed up with, especially if there's a charge-ordered state in the system. So if this function, which is used in setting the location of the tip, becomes heterogeneous, then DIDV is not the density of states. Okay, so here's our material. We're going to tunnel to this through this surface. Bismuth atoms are above the copper atoms. Here's what the surface looks like. Each white dot is a bismuth atom with a copper atom of about 5 angstroms below. Here's what the differential conductance looks like near optimal doping. I argued that it represents a good D-wave BCS superconductor. And if we look at low energies here, we see spatial variations in the density of states whose arrangements are different at different energies. There are weak dispersive modulations in the density of states inside the gap near the node. What these are scattering between the regions of high joint density of states in the superconducting band structure. There are 8 of them, given the symmetries of the electronic structure in the crystal, and that means there are 16 pairs of scattering vectors, and these vectors should evolve as the electronic structure does in a very characteristic way. And that's precisely what one sees if you take the Fourier transform of the real space modulations and run it as a function of energy. You see the 16 Q vectors evolving to different locations in Q space. There's the Fermi point, and now the empty states are evolving back again. It's particle hole symmetric evolution. By using this model, and there are seven independent geometrical equations relating the location where the scattering is coming from, and the Q vectors, which are measured from the Fourier transform. By using several independent, you can use multiple independent equations here. They all tell you that the scattering came from the Fermi surface. And it allows us to measure the superconducting energy gap as a function of angle in momentum space. This picture is confirmed in detail by photoemission. However, at low doping, we had been stymied now for about 2 years since 05. Because this setup error, where the density of the differential conductance is no longer the density of states, the set point effect, caused us to lose the ability to do a successful quasiparticle interference study. We weren't measuring something correctly. Okay, so here's what happens to the electronic structure. If you measure the gap, superconducting energy gap, it's heterogeneous at the nanoscale. We know the reason for this, it's the dopant atoms. If we go down in doping, the disorder remains and the gap value rises on this pseudo-gap energy scale, just as I said. If we take the various spectra, which can be measured, associated with each different type of gap value, we can fit them to a density of states function, which produces, in theory, spectra like this. And the fits are excellent. That allows us to extract the real value of the energy gap over a wide range of doping. And here it is. This is the extracted energy gap as a function of doping from this fitting scheme. It's completely consistent with all the other reports of what the pseudo-gap energy scale does. In addition to which, we have the scattering rate growing with falling doping. Okay, now turn to tunneling asymmetry. The other thing that happens as we go down in doping is that the characteristic D-wave spectrum, so familiar to us, evolves into something very different. It becomes highly asymmetric. So this is positive sample bias, the probability of injecting an electron, and this is negative sample bias, the probability of extracting an electron. You're going away from a metallic state now. The probability of injecting is becoming different than the probability of extracting. Here are the two extremes. We have recently discovered, just in the last year or so, that this tunneling asymmetry is basically universal at low doping in the cuprates. And the closer you approach to the Mott insulator, the more asymmetric the two processes become. It becomes relatively easier to extract an electron than to inject one until you reach the insulator, at which point you definitely can never inject an electron, but you can still extract one. So here is Anderson. Oh yeah, you can extract an electron from, if you have a big enough chemical potential difference, you can take an electron out.
If there is an electron there.
But in the Mott insulator, if you have one electron per site, okay, and the site is split by the Hubbard energy, you could extract that electron, but you can't put in another electron until you exceed the Hubbard energy, which is about 3 volts. So this tunneling asymmetry is universal. Here's Anderson and Ong's proposal. Here's my cartoon, just to help you to think about it. Imagine injecting an electron into this field of view. Well, the probability to inject one into a Mott insulator is related to the number of available targets, the number of holes. The probability to extract one is related to the number of electrons. And clearly, they're different, and they're becoming more different as you go towards the insulator. So here is a picture from this paper. Originally, they proposed that we should just measure the probability for injection divided by the probability for extraction at some energy. We call that function z. And in theory, that would be approximately equal to twice the hole density when you work out the details. Here's a somewhat more detailed analysis, which is in good agreement with this picture by Randeria, Trivedi, and Fushan Zhang. And what they propose is we take the integrated probability for injection. We integrate under this curve, let's say this one. That's the integrated density of states. And then we integrate the probability of extraction. And we take the ratio of those two numbers, and that's also related to twice the hole density, in theory. This tunneling asymmetry has some interesting practical issues associated with it, though, which have turned out to be very useful. So the differential conductance is supposed to be the density of states. The ratio proposed by Randeria et al., R was supposed to be the integrated density of states. But our observable is differential conductance. Differential conductance integrated over voltage is just current. So this ratio is just the ratio of the net current at this bias for injection divided by the net current at this bias for extraction. It's rather easy to measure. The original variable Z is a ratio of differential conductances. It retains its meaning. They're both highly beneficial because these unknown factors, the matrix elements, the work functions, and this strange topograph, are canceled out. Here's the equation for the current. If you take the current at V plus and the current at V minus, but at the same location, then these numbers are all the same at that location, and they get divided in the ratio. So this ratio is a ratio of densities of states, and it doesn't suffer the systematic error that I earlier pointed out. And similarly for DIDV. If we take the ratio of differential conductances, these terms get canceled out. So we get a new type of information, which is a ratio of injection to extraction, but the information doesn't suffer from some of the systematic errors which came from the original metallic picture of tunneling. Yeah?
Last question about the tunneling matrix element.
Yeah.
You know, in the C-axis,
yeah.
The transport in the C-axis,
yeah.
The velocity is different. For the nodal particle, it's very heavy, difficult to move along the C-axis, but for the particle that's a pi zero, it's quite a large group velocity in the C-axis.
Correct.
So I'm not sure whether this, if you measure this the tunneling differential conductance,
yeah.
as a low energy,
yeah.
you suppress the contribution significantly smaller.
You probably do suppress the contribution near the nodes a little bit, that's quite correct, so that the intensity of the signal, this raw signal, would be reduced. But nevertheless, this argument is still correct. Even if this matrix element needs a description in momentum space, it gets divided out by the ratio.
Yeah, but that depends on energy.
It does depend on energy, but it's particle hole symmetric, so that it does get divided out near the Fermi energy. I can show you the equations. So here's tunneling asymmetry results. We took two different materials. We wanted to validate that this really was a useful new idea. So we took two different materials. This is a BISCO material. This is an oxychloride material. But they both have superconducting CuO2 planes. Here's a cartoon of where we break the crystal. The top surface of this one is calcium chloride. The top surface of this one is bismuth oxide. Those tunneling matrix elements are different in the two cases. Crystal symmetries are different, and even the doping process is different. Here you substitute a sodium atom on the calcium site, and here you put an interstitial oxygen atom underneath the top layer. So chemically and physically, these are two very, very different materials. In fact, they're only we chose them. Their only common characteristic is that they have a whole doped CuO2 plane, approximately the same doping, near 10%. So the argument we wanted to make is that the termination layers here are physically and chemically very different, and the dopant process is completely different. So no crystal-specific property could explain common phenomena detected by the STM, except for the CuO2 plane. So we ascribe whatever we see to common intrinsic features of the CuO2 plane electronic structure. So here we go. This is a picture of oxychloride. Each dot here is a chlorine atom. This is a picture of BISCO. Each dot here is a bismuth atom. The two fields of view are the same size. First of all, let's take some of these asymmetric spectra, just at different locations in these fields of view. And you see the basic set of characteristics we're detecting is the same in both cases. The spectra are highly asymmetric, and they vary rapidly from location to location. Now, it looks here like somehow they're homogeneous on this side and they're heterogeneous on this side. But that has to do with how you do the experiment. We have to keep the integral on one side constant. That's how we get the tip into position. So all that you can say about this really is that the ratio is fluctuating wildly from atom to atom. Now think about a regular piece of material. By that I mean a metal. Go to a gold atom and a piece of gold and ask yourself, is the probability of injecting an electron at the site of that gold atom going to be different than the probability of extracting it? And even if it was, if you just moved one atom away, would you get a different ratio of probabilities? Of course, in a homogeneous crystal, the answer is no. But there are no impurities in this crystal. There are dopant atoms. So this asymmetry is itself an amazing observation.
James, the spatial dependence does seem strange, but if you were ascribing the asymmetry earlier to definitely a correlation effect relating to U, but if I think about some very weakly doped semiconductor, doped so lightly that it's not conducting, you still would have the Fermi level in some impurity band, and
correct,
there'd be a pronounced asymmetry.
Correct.
That you could imagine.
I completely.
That's not necessarily a correlation effect.
I completely agree. So let's go back here. I would like to correct you just on one point. So I was not ascribing it to correlations. These authors were ascribing it to correlations.
Very good.
Okay. But it has proved a tremendously productive technique.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so here's what we're dealing with. This asymmetry, this strange variation of the probability, is changing from atom to atom. So let's make a map now. We're going to make this ratio map. It's the integral of empty states divided by the integral of filled states, and we have to choose an energy. We chose up to 150 millivolts. So here in the oxychloride, if we make this ratio map, it looks like this. You see, it strongly breaks the translational, the unit, the periodic structure, the translational structure of the crystal, and it also breaks the rotational structure of the crystal, which has C4 symmetry, but this image of the electronic structure has C2 symmetry. So this could be all a big mistake. Maybe there's something weird about the top of this material. So let's see if we do it in another material. What does it look like? The same ratio, same size of field of view, but otherwise a completely different material. It looks like that. They are statistically identical. They have the same elementary objects in both environments. It's my opinion that here you are imaging a genuine property of that n-body state, the new state from which the high TC superconductivity is emerging. It breaks translational symmetry. It has a characteristic period here of 4 unit cells. And it breaks rotational symmetry, breaking down C4 to C2. But it has no long-range order. We could not detect any long-range order in these experiments. So there's an indistinguishable tunneling asymmetry contrast with disperse 4 unit cell-wide domains. There's one. We can zoom in and look at them a little bit. Here's the edge of one 4-unit cell wide domain, and here's another one. Zoom in some more. Basically, they're electronically identical once we choose the most ordered object. They're virtually indistinguishable in terms of the observables. Now, this contrast is oxygen site-centered. Let's go back a little bit just for the fun of it. So if the only sites which are electronically active in this material are the copper sites, then when you image the electronic structure, you shouldn't really see something which is more finely detailed than the crystal lattice of the copper sites. But of course you do. This is a much more finely detailed image than this one. And similarly over here, this is a much more finely detailed. How is it possible to have additional electronic structure smaller than your copper site-centered unit cell? Well, of course, the answer is that there are 2 more atoms in each unit cell, the oxygen atoms. So the oxygen sites are playing the key role here. So let me show you how we know that. We take one of these guys. We zoom in. I rotated it so this domain is vertical. Zoom in some more. This is exactly 4 unit cells. And now let me show you where the copper and oxygen atoms are. So the black guys are copper. Copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen, copper, oxygen. So the blue guys are oxygen. So just look at this site here now. There's an oxygen atom there. Look at this site here. There's an oxygen atom there. They share a copper atom. But whatever is the electronic structure here is different than here. There's an oxygen atom here. And there's an oxygen atom here. So what you see is that these oxygens, although they're in the same plaquette and they share the same corner, coppers, have different electronic structures. So this is a bond-centered modulation of the electronic structure, at least of the excitations, which is what we measure here. We can look in detail at one of these domains. And by knowing where all the atoms are, we can show that its electronic structure, these features are the same as these features in the other material. These features are the same as these features in the completely different material. The chances that you would get this identical electronic arrangement by virtue of some disorder mechanism in two completely different materials is zero, in my opinion. This is an intrinsic property of the electronic structure. Okay, so I think these amazing effects, here I just colorized them to make it a little bit easier to see the breakings of symmetry and the fact that they're made of elementary bond-centered patterns. They're not due to tunneling matrix elements. They're not due to dopant atoms. What would be required for dopant atoms to somehow arrange themselves to do this would be that some random process would cause them to order in space in exactly the same way in two different species in two different materials. So I don't believe it. We believe that this is intrinsic to the CuO2 plane electronic structure. One couldn't prove that it would still be there if there were no dopant atoms, but there are no bulk cuprates without dopant atoms. Now I want to turn to the other new piece of information, which is measuring the gap dispersion, the superconducting energy gap dispersion, by using quasiparticle interference, now at low dopings approaching the Mott insulator. Now, I told you that at low doping, our quasiparticle interference tool failed because of the set point effect. The differential conductance is not the density of states.
Seamus?
Yes?
Those plots were all current ratios, is that right?
These ones are current ratios.
You mentioned also the differential conductance ratios.
We'll come on to those. They're extremely revealing. So you anticipated me by half a slide. In order to eliminate this quasiparticle interference effect, one thing we can do is take the ratio of the differential conductance, in order to limit the set point effect, we can take the ratio of differential conductances because it cancels these unknown and very problematic terms. So now we want to search for quasiparticle interference, basically interfering wave functions, in this ratio of differential conductances. And here's a movie of that ratio at different energies. You see these patterns, you go down in energy, and you come to somewhere near 30 millivolts, and you start to see dispersing interference patterns, dispersing back again. And then at an intermediate energy, they turn back into these static patterns. This is already an extremely interesting picture of the situation. So this ratio resolved by energy exhibits some very complex energy dependence. Here we go down, we have static patterns. Now we get dispersing patterns, dispersing back again, and now we go back to the static patterns. The Fourier transform of the dispersing piece, we were so delighted to see this. It's a perfect octet model. It's the only way this can happen is if it's interference of D-wave Bogoliubov quasiparticles. It has all the necessary symmetries, particle hole symmetry, gap symmetry on the Fermi surface. What this shows us is that at low energies, below 30 millivolts, we have excellent D-wave Bogoliubov quasiparticles. Here's what we were looking for in terms of the 16 Q vectors. We can find all 16 Q vectors at many energies here. We can use this model to analyze this data. Here are the equations. And from it, we can find where did the scattering come from. At least we see it coming from here. And we can measure the superconducting energy gap as a function of angle in momentum space. And this gap, this is a heavily overdetermined result. We used many independent Q vectors to test that this result is correct. So here's the outcome. Here's the energy gap as a function of angle in momentum space. Here is the node, the gap is zero. And the gap is heading on this trajectory. And the best fit tells us that the superconducting energy gap is heading for 80 millivolts. So even though TC is going down, the D-wave superconducting energy gap is going up. But of course, there is another energy scale in here. It's this scale. The actual existence of the delocalized Bogoliubov quasiparticles is terminated at this energy, somewhere near 28 millivolts. So you have a separation into two very different energies. Here's how it would be represented in a photoemission study. You have a Fermi surface. On this part of the Fermi surface, you have interference of well-defined states in momentum space, which are gapped by an 80 millivolt gap. Here, we don't see any interference, but we can project that function and show that it would hit the zone phase at 81 millivolts. Now look at this. This is the plot I showed you of the energy gap maximum in the spectra evolving with doping, and we come to here. And this is the plot of the superconducting energy gap at the same low doping. And these two numbers are the same.
Shouldn't the gap be linear?
Yes, it should. Well, no, here this isn't cosine 2 theta k, this is just theta k. But the gap should be more linear in this graph than it is. Quite correct. But even if, you know, suppose I draw a straight line through this data set and the node, the gap maximum is still going to be very high. There's no way we have misunderstood that. Okay, one more piece of information now. This pseudo-gap energy scale gap is highly disordered at low doping, but now the range of energies where we find it is centered on about 80 millivolts, as I tried to tell you. We can look at these spectra. We can often find a peak over here. Here's a sample of different spectra. So oftentimes over here, we can't find any peak. But if we make a map of these peaks, we can usually find that one. Here's the rather poor one. Here's the one where we can usually find the peaks. And that pseudo-gap scale is disordered. Here's the histogram. Its mean value is at 82 millivolts. So the superconducting energy gap dispersion is heading for the same value as the mean value of the pseudo-gap scale. So the point I'm trying to bring home to you here is there's no a priori evidence for any other phenomenon here. It just seems to be one phenomenon. Okay, so the last piece now. If we focus on this pseudo-gap scale, these states here. Yeah.
So there's this other energy, I forgot what you called it, the red dots.
Down here, delta zero, yeah.
Is that related to the, you had fitted some scattering rate or imaginary self-energy in the?
Good question. So it could be that once that scattering rate gets high enough, and it's growing as a function of angle, once it gets high enough, it's no longer possible to solve the pairing equation and get Cooper pairs.
But do you have separate definitions of them?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Correlate?
Yeah, we can correlate them. I could show you that graph if you like. Yeah. So that could be one reason why the energy range where you have coherent Bogoliubov states is getting terminated somewhere in the middle of the zone. All right, now let's look at the pseudo-gap excitations. We're doing well here. Here they are. So why do I say that? So this is what I just presented to you for oxychloride and for BISCO. It's the integral. It's a current, a ratio of injection current divided by extraction current with atomic resolution, this function. But this doesn't tell us which energy is involved in making these patterns. It's an integral over a wide range of energies. So we wanted to find out, is there some characteristic energy scale associated with these bond-centered patterns? So we attempted to use these energy-resolved differential conductance ratio maps, like the one I already showed you. But they don't seem to have any particular energy. There's a wide range of energies, except where you have Bogoliubov quasiparticles here. Okay, watch this. So here comes the tunneling asymmetry pattern, 50 millivolts, 100 millivolts, 140 millivolts. It seems to be there at all energies. So we couldn't distinguish what is the characteristic energy of this effect. So let's study it in detail. I'll show you a plot of this ratio of differential conductance on a trajectory including a number of oxygen atoms. That's this trajectory. It's covering these, I guess, 8 oxygen atoms. And at each atom, we know what this differential conductance spectrum is. And this function is the ratio of the value on one side, let's say conductance at plus 100 divided by conductance at minus 100. So let's plot that ratio along this line. That's the Z ratio. What you should notice by looking at this ratio is that it does have a characteristic energy. There is an energy where this tunneling asymmetry becomes intense. That's, we know that because of these peaks in the ratio, and they occur at some well-defined energy. Now, how come we couldn't see that before? Let's see what it actually looks like. As you go up towards that energy, you see the pattern very clearly, and then you go beyond that energy, and it disappears. Sorry. So now we have discovered what's going on, why we weren't able to find the characteristic energy. This high gap scale is disordered at the atomic scale. So these yellow regions have a gap energy of 65 millivolts. If I image the tunneling asymmetry at 65 millivolts, it's well correlated with the yellow regions. If I look at the gap near 100 millivolts, that are these green regions, they're well correlated with the tunneling asymmetry in the green regions. And similarly, if I look at 120 millivolts, these blue regions, the tunneling asymmetry is detected at 120 millivolts. So what's happening is that the energy at which the tunneling asymmetry is being detected is just disordered in space. It's the same phenomenon, it's just happening at a bunch of different energies at different locations. So you can fix that. You just rescale all the energies, measure the energy in units of the pseudo-gap energy, which is different at different locations. You rescale to the pseudo-gap energy. When this number, little e, equals 1, then you're looking at the asymmetry which is coming from the pseudo-gap energy. So here's what it looks like. Indeed, the contrast comes exactly from the pseudo-gap energy. And I'll prove that to you in a second. Here it comes back again. 7, 8.9, 1. That's where the maximum contrast is coming from. So you can analyze this mathematically. You just take the average value of this asymmetry, subtract the local value from the average value. That'll give you a map of variations. And then you can calculate the variance as a function of energy in units of the pseudo-gap energy. So we don't see much at low energies. And as we approach the pseudo-gap energy, we see a big maximum in the variance associated with the bond-centered pattern that I already introduced. And now we go outside the pseudo-gap energy and it disappears rather quickly. Okay, so what that tells us is that the tunneling asymmetry contrast is concentrated at the pseudo-gap energy scale. What's actually happening is that this probability for injection divided by this probability for extraction is being modulated in space in this bond-centered pattern, which is 4 unit cells wide and breaks translational and rotational symmetry. And the modulations are concentrated at the energy scale of the pseudo-gap. How were we so lucky as to detect it in the past? It's because R is an integral over energy, and we happen to integrate over all the energies where the variations were occurring. But this is an image of the ratio of these peaks as a function of location. And this is an image of R, and they're, except for the increased contrast here, they're identical. Okay. Great. If we fit the density of our differential tunneling conductance spectra by a model including a D-wave gap and a linear scattering rate, we can follow the gap magnitude as a function of hole doping, and it tracks along the classic pseudo-gap line. If we do an experiment here just below 10%, the pseudo-gap scale, which we can measure by direct observation, is about 80 millivolts. If we do a quasi-particle interference experiment in exactly the same field of view, in exactly the same sample, there's a range of energies and momenta where we see very clear Bogoliubov quasi-particles. That's a lower energy range. I call it delta zero. But the gap dispersion for these quasi-particles is heading to the 80 millivolt scale, to the pseudo-gap scale. So what that gives us is the following picture. If you try to describe the electronic structure in momentum space, there's a piece near the node which has beautiful D-wave excitations. And if you try to describe momentum space near the antinode of this dispersion relationship, you see that it is patterned in real space. I hesitate to say localized because for theorists that has a very specific meaning. But it is local and it is patterned in real space. And you should think of this as some alteration in the probability of excitation rather than a static picture, let's say, of charge. Because what these experiments do is measure the probability for generating an excitation. Because otherwise this doesn't make any sense. If I tell you I have a charge density pattern that looks like this, and it's coexisting simultaneously with a 40 Kelvin homogeneous superconductor, that's impossible. So the way to think about it is the low energy excitations are the excitations from a BCS state, and the high energy excitations are the excitations from whatever really is the fundamental state there, but I don't yet know what that state is. But they're bond-centered, they break translational and rotational symmetry, and they're associated with the pseudo-gap energy. So now we think of this as visualizing the mysterious pseudo-gap electronic structure of the cuprates. It's got no long-range order. That's a really good thing because no long-range order had ever been detected by any bulk technique. It's not inconsistent with 17 years of searches for long-range order. There isn't long-range order. But it's got short-range order.
At
around 10%, between 8 and 10.
Well, I see a kind of orientational order. I mean that four-fold axis. So if you take, to say, cosine 4 pi, an average.
Yeah. Or d2x squared minus d2y squared. Yeah, it has a four-fold order. You're quite correct. But it's got no long range. The correlation function of that image has no long-range order in it. The dominant thing here is the C2 symmetry. The bond between one copper atom and the next copper atom can be in one state or a different state, or in the first state or in a different state. You can tile the surface with this picture. Two different bond states. Of necessity, that breaks the C4 symmetry both of the antiferromagnet and of the original RVB state proposed for the cuprates. Both of those have C4 symmetry, but this has C2 symmetry. This picture has C2 symmetry, locally.
The 4A commensuration, is it inconsistent with like momentum?
It could be. It's not inconsistent at this stage. The classic stripe picture was one where you have antiferromagnetism and holes separated from each other. Under those circumstances, the edge of the stripe, if it was antiferromagnetic, would retain its C4 symmetry. So that's about the only point where we detect a little bit of disagreement with that picture. But I think some of those classic pictures of stripes were a little bit naive. So here's what I was emphasizing. We're dealing really with something which has a C2 symmetry in the electronic structure and tiles this object. By the way, if you look at this object, it's high, low, high, low. If you look over here, you get high, low, high, sorry, high, low. This plaquette is electronically equivalent to that plaquette if you rotate it by 90 degrees. So the two rotations of this object do exist, and they're tiled on the surface in some way. Okay, so that's about all I have to say about the data, and to my colleagues, I'd like to say thanks very much.
Of all the theories you mentioned in the beginning, which one would be most comfortable with?
The one which has the highest probability to be consistent with this set of data, in my opinion, is some form of crystallization of pairs. This would be a valence bond glass, if you take it at face value. But don't forget, a valence bond crystallar glass would be an insulator, and this is a 40 Kelvin superconductor. So this is a picture of the probability of generating an excitation from the ground state, and I don't know what that ground state is. And I don't know how to work backwards from the knowledge of the excitations to the ground state without a theory. right? We're so used to the traditional picture where you measure the excitations, but you have the theory so you can identify the ground state. Here we know what the excitations are, but we don't know what the ground state is. Yeah?
Is there any way you can do some sort of thermal cycling and come back to the same spot and see if that pattern has changed, or is that...
We probably won't do that, but there are several high temperature spectroscopic STMs which have recently come online, and somebody will do it.
A picture
that I can't defend, but which is in my subconscious, is that the original RVB picture, which is a product state of all different singlet pairs, the low energy pairs, which are large in space, are condensed into the superconductor, and here are the excitations from that coherent piece. And the high energy pairs, which are still there in the ground state, are somehow not condensed into the superconductor. But in fact, they are, they're somehow patterned in real space. So the segregation is not between a D-wave superconductor and a charge density wave. It's between things which are delocalized in momentum space at low energy and which are more local at high energy. It's between local and delocal.
So the transition is like recombination, yeah? Like formation of molecules from, say, hydrogen.
Pairwise. Yeah. That's a very interesting question. Suppose you could make a H2 superfluid and put it on a surface, and then measure the spectrum of excitations. So at low energies, you would find the Bogoliubov excitations of the bosonic superfluid. But there's some energy at which you would actually excite the singlet of the H2 molecule, and that would look different than the Bogoliubov excitations. So intuitively, although I definitely can't prove it, I have some picture like that in my mind.
That is opposite to limiting case.
Yeah.